please join me in warmly welcoming to this stage the President of the New York Public Library, Paul Leclerc, and André Assiman.
Thank you very much, Paul, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for coming out on a rainy, windy, cold evening for this conversation and for the next phase of the conversation, which will be questions from you to André, not to me, because he is a star, and we're privileged to have him with us tonight. What strikes me is really kind of unusual is how André and Paul and I are interconnected together with one other person in the room. It's my friend Dorothy Perlstein, who first recommended André to me as a writer when she let me borrow a copy of Out of Egypt, a book that I bet most of us, if not everyone in the room, has read. And it was, for me at least, a book that I never wanted to end. I thought it was ravishingly beautiful, one of the great, great works of the last 25 years. Easily, if we don't go farther back than that. Maybe since Candide, I don't know. One of the special sort of aspects or privileges of being here at as the president of the library is that if you read a book that you like and the author is anywhere in the metropolitan region, you can get in touch with that person and say, I read your book, I'd love to meet you, will you come and have a cup of tea with me? So I haven't done it often enough, but the first time I ever did it was with André, and he came to the office, and we got to know each other, and that was how many years ago?
Gosh, 1997 or 96.
96, and he's been a very, very special person. He and his wife, Susan, have been special people in my life and my wife, Judith's life, and it's a privilege and an honor for me to be with him here this evening. At the same time, at one point, he said to me, you really have to meet this guy who's in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art named Paul Holdengraber. He's really exceptional. And I think it was you who gave me some copies of the LA Times, which had articles on Paul, in which he was described as an intellectual Lenny Bruce, which I guess sort of fits. Paul, where are you sitting? I don't see you. He's back there, okay. So we had an opening at the library to take on the leadership of our public programs. And so the president here doesn't hire people except like the most senior executives. So we had a search committee and I said, meet this guy. He sounds terrific. So they met him and he was terrific. And then I came into play because I went out to Santa Monica and spent time with Paul. And really got a sense instantaneously, as you all have if you've been to these programs before, about how much sizzle there is in him. So André, all of us owe Paul to you, because and to Dorothy. And you know, this is like the great chain of being. Everything goes back and forth. So from Dorothy to me about your book, me asking you for tea, you then telling me, look at Holdengraber, me telling them to look at Holdengraber, me meeting Holdengraber. And then look what's happened ever since. One of the great, great public programs in New York with more sizzle, more imagination, more energy, more passion, more intelligence, more creativity than I think any other place could possibly have. So thank you very much for that gift. And thank you for coming this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. We're going to go from sort of maybe the general to the particular, and we're going to have two interludes in this conversation in which André will read from his book. It's brand new, and we're not going to get too much into the details of the book itself, I think, because our assumption is that not that many of you have yet had the privilege and the joy of reading Eight White Nights. But to start with the most general kind of question, and we're talking to a very distinguished academic as well as a brilliant writer, the head of the doctoral program in comparative literature at the CUNY Graduate School. And here's the starter, okay? A while back I was asked to fill in for Natan Sharansky at a benefit dinner in interviewing a very famous and an extraordinary Talmudic scholar named Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz.
Oh.
And Rabbi Steinsaltz is known for many, many things. One of the things he's known for is answering questions at very, very great length. So my job as the first Gentile to ever interview him, was to get him to be concise. So here is the lead-off question. What's the meaning of life, and has it changed over time? And he answered it in five minutes. So, Andre, what's the meaning of literature, and has it changed over time?
Oh, am I glad you asked this question. The meaning of literature is something I'm not going to touch on. I teach for that. But I think that there's, when one starts to write a book, one starts with a subconscious or subliminal sense of what literature is, and is this going to be literature, or is this going to be something else, or is it going to be like sort of a novel that you buy at the train station that you leave on the train, even if you don't finish? So there are certain assumptions one makes, and one of the things one wants to do is to embrace a problem, give it a face, give it a plot if you can, and sort of weave in and out of that problem certain questions that are very hard to ask and certainly harder to answer, so that you have a man and a woman, and usually it is about love. Most of literature is about love if it's not about war. And one wants to see how these two energies or these two souls will do battle together before something happens or may not happen. But I think that literature is always interested in asking questions that are very difficult and certainly refuses to give easy answers.
Well, you remind me of Frank Kermode then in that way, because Kermode believes that literature should be difficult, no?
It is difficult. It is challenging. And of course, when you say literature, I'm looking at my book. Is it literature? Is it not? It's too soon to tell. But I think that literature is challenging because it wants you, each time you read a book of literature, to be puzzled and baffled enough so that you think, I have to learn how to read all over again. This book wants me to read it differently than the way I read, say, Sherlock Holmes or the way I read Homer. Every book wants to be read differently. If you want to read books, different books, in the same way, you're not really reading literature, or you don't know how to read literature.
And when you read a work of literature more than once, you're always reading a new book?
You're reading a new book, because you have changed, and, you know, books also have lives, they change, and you see different things, and you always sort of slap your head and say, how come I never noticed this? I've taught this book 4 times, and I never taught this passage, and yet it feels like it's seminal. And one always feels that one is growing. You know, Emerson was really fantastic about this. You grow towards the book, but lo and behold, the book grows towards you as well. And these are confluences that are, I think, have a bit of the meaning of life in them already.
Was there at the outset of this book, I mean, before you began to write it, and you wrote part of it here with us at
yes.
the Coleman Center,
right.
Was there a particular problem that you set yourself to solve?
Well, I was confronted with this idea of this man and this woman, and I didn't want to take the easy way out. The easy way out would be man meets woman at a party, they chit-chat a while, maybe they chit-chat too much, and then either that night or the next night or certainly the night after, something happens that we call sex. And I decided that there are so many things that are fascinating about the meeting of two individuals, that to speed it up would be sort of doing an injustice. It doesn't interest me to speed it up. I wanted every conceivable doubt to sort of hold center stage for a while, every conceivable fear, ambivalence, everything to come into play. And of course, my ambivalence may be resolved, but it is fed yet again by the other person who has her or his other ambivalences mm-hmm. that then sort of stir mine up all over again. So this is a novel about a romance, but also a romance that is frozen in time for 7 days.
Mm-hmm. But in your last book, people moved to action.
They did.
Without hesitation.
Yes, and I was not going to sort of mince my words either. But it's very funny because I began 8 White Nights quite a few years ago here, in fact. And then it got stymied because this idea of freezing the moment really demanded me to write in a different way than I had written, say, Out of Egypt. This was really an intellectual book. It required, if you wanted to be honest, you had to really move very slowly. And I got bogged down by the slowness. It just affected me. And so I decided to change gears and do something totally new. And I wrote this other book, which benefited from Eight White Nights, so that many of the passages in Call Me By Your Name were more or less lifted from here, so that I couldn't use them again. So the energy that you have in Call Me By Your Name comes from here. So now this was basically left bereft of any energy. It had it had to really be honest to itself and realize that energy was not what it was after. It was really after that thing that happens between two individuals when there is no moving forward, or when they're experienced enough to know that they can move forward, but that they will ruin it if they move forward too fast.
Well, one of the problems that occurs in the narrative, it seems to me, is the man is reluctant to move too fast, explicitly.
Yes.
More than, there is no name for the male character. I mean, there's a nickname for him, Prince Oscar. But you'll get to find out why when you read the book. But there's sort of a moment of drama when she's ready, but he isn't, no?
Well, he's ready and she's not. And then she's ready and he's not. And we've all been there. I mean, this is nothing new. But yes, it is very unusual to have a man say, you know, maybe this is going too fast. Usually it's the woman who says that. So I had to, but I believed it. I've said it. So it was not something that came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I thought that this was really the honest thing to do. Now, clearly, I could be much more macho and have the man says, yes, thank God you asked, I'm all ready to go. But I didn't want that because it's not in line with the character himself. These are two very ambivalent human beings. And I understand ambivalence because I live ambivalence.
How many precedents are there in serious literature for male protagonists to be as hesitant as this one is?
I can't think of one. I mean, there are men who bungle seduction,
right,
and therefore decide, I really didn't want to anyway. But in this case, I don't know. I don't think of any. I cannot think
of
one.
So you're breaking new ground here.
Yes, okay.
A new archetype?
The man who says no.
So the man who says how neurotic do you find this guy?
I'm sorry?
How neurotic do you find him?
I think he is neurotic, but I don't think... See, that's a psychological term, and I didn't want to... I'd never used the word neurotic in the book. And I didn't want to use that because I think it immediately forces you to calc him, to make him into a thing that you recognize. I don't know if he's neurotic. I think that most people are very doubtful of their own feelings, and if you freeze a day in your life and you go through and you jot down every single feeling you've had, you'll see very well that, you know, in the morning I said that I liked, you know, lasagna, and in the afternoon I hate lasagna, and in the evening I love it again. But I think that life is that way, where we hesitate and we change our minds. And Montaigne was sort of the father of this. We don't have a position. And I think this character has nothing. He doesn't even have a name. I didn't want to give him a name. He doesn't have a religion. He's Jewish, but he calls himself a runcible Jew. He has no real cultural affiliation that you can recognize. He has no profession. Reviewers get very annoyed when you don't give a profession. What does he do for a living? It's immaterial, okay? And all these facts have been removed, and really the reason why I removed those is that I didn't want to write the kind of novel where you have all these things to help you. And in fact, and I'll ask this question of the audience, if you removed your name, your parents, your lineage, your profession, your titles, your address, then the question becomes, now tell me who you are. And you're totally baffled. You have nothing to go on. Mm-hmm. You don't even have friends and lovers. Those have been removed as well. Now, who am I? And that's, I think, the condition of the main narrator. He is not crazy. He's not afflicted with any diseases. He is just normal up to a point, but he doesn't have any references that you could understand.
Right, but he's not equally matched. I mean, you move him, quite interestingly, you move him at the end, towards the end, into his own world with his old friends, the people who you used to hang out with, and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. But right from the very beginning, he's placed in a brand new world that's highly exotic to him, threatening in a way.
Right.
And then on the first page, I think, he meets Clara. And this struck me as being sort of reminiscent of Call Me By Your Name, because you've got one person who is totally smitten by and almost obsessive about another person who is more exotic than he is, who comes from a different world, who is not, if not unapproachable, at least sort of hard to get close to,
right.
and each of whom uses a sort of lapidary sentence or term right from the get-go. And so it struck me that there was a similar kind of beginning to these two, and you have the male protagonist in this instance who is always put off balance by this woman. And what is it about her that lets her do that to him? Or what is it about him that lets her put him in such a vulnerable position continuously, so that he's always afraid that he's going to be exposing himself, looking foolish, and so on and so
yeah.
forth, and afraid of commitment, these kinds of, if I'm not to call them neurotic, at least, kinds of issues that strike me as being sort of 20th or late 20th century issues in terms of...
They are. You're already putting a date on it. And I don't know how to explain this. The only thing I can say is that there have been incidents in all our lives, and I don't mean to generalize this way, but you're lucky if it has happened, where you meet someone who is, as the title of this new movie is, not in your league. In other words, they're in a different league. They're in a higher league. They are, let's face it, whether you like it or not, they're better than you are. Okay? Now, your job is to say, okay, I'm going to bring them down, or I'm going to rise to their level. I can do this. Or you can try, and every time you try, you're beaten down. You're reminded that your place is not in their league. And that's what this woman, Clara, does. She just not disembowels him, but she leaves all his devices, his shenanigans, everything he could try, turn out to be totally functionless. At some point at the party, because there's a long party, in the first night, he falls apart. Why does he fall apart? Because he picks up something to eat, it's very peppery, and he basically starts crying. And he's almost fainting because it's so hot in his mouth that he doesn't know what to do, and he feels totally, as we would, totally vulnerable, totally exposed. And so that at that point, he's just a raw nerve, and she's just waiting for him to recover. I told you not to eat this. Why did you do this? And this happens twice at the party, where he basically doesn't pay attention, and he tries to rise, and at some point, he just gives up.
But then he winds up later on in the emergency room at Mount Sinai.
Yes.
With a sort of an anxiety attack.
That's correct.
Because of her.
Because
of
her.
Or because of himself in not being able to deal with her in effect superiority, no?
Well, you know, he thought everything was in the bag, it was going to happen, everything's good, I'm going to bring her breakfast. He's already got the scenario set up. I'll buy her the same muffins she bought for me that morning. And he is on the verge of leaving the house. She says, look, I really have to go downtown to meet a friend. And he says, okay, when will I see you? She says, well, you know, I'll see you like sometime in the afternoon. And he says, well, basically, we've all been there. When the person you're dying to call tells you not to call, and you have now 8 hours to wait for that moment when you will actually see if you're going to be alive that evening or not. And these 8 hours can last, as you know, they can last forever. And he's totally exposed to this, and he just collapses and has an anxiety attack and goes to the hospital, thinks he's dying or having a heart attack. The guy says, no, you know what? You're having women problems.
And the doctor in the emergency room at one point says to him, maybe talking to someone might help, like a psychiatrist. Do you think he needs psychiatry?
Oh, I think he definitely shouldn't use some psychiatry, yes. Yeah,
well, we all should, but he in particular?
No, I think no more than any of us. I think we are a nation of anxiety-ridden human beings, let's face it. We could all use the couch at least twice a week. And if we don't, we're putting a good show.
I'm going to ask Andre to read in a moment, but first I want to ask one more question. And this comes from the issue of the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement, that arrived in the mail today. And it's the beginning of a review of the movie A Single Man by Peter Parker. Rereading his novel A Single Man a few months after its publication in 1964, Christopher Isherwood felt the pleasure that comes from observing a job well done, quotation. "It achieves exactly what I wanted it to achieve," he wrote in his diary. "I keep dipping into it, and I always feel, and always I feel, yes, that is exactly the effect I was trying for." Have you had that experience with this?
Yes, I have. I mean, does this sound too self-satisfied?
No.
It's not me to be that way.
He doesn't sound self-satisfied.
Well, that's Christopher Isherwood. This is Andre Assam, a totally different beast. I'm usually very, very doubtful of myself, but I look back at it and I say, oh my God, yes, this is exactly what I wanted to capture. This is what I hope the reader will say. I didn't get it the first time, but if they have the patience to keep going, you say, oh my God, yes, I know that feeling exactly. I know that feeling when you're with someone and silence suddenly settles between you. And that is, could be a wonderful thing. We're enjoying the silence. Or it could be torture. What do I say next? And maybe I could read a passage that bears on that.
Good.
Is that okay?
Yes, let's do it.
This is basically, they meet at the party, by almost by coincidence. I say almost because I'm no longer sure. And he's had his little crisis with the pepper, and she takes him outside on the balcony. It's the Christmas Eve, so it is cold, but it's not totally freezing. And so they can stand outside. And I'm going to read, it's going to take about 5-7 minutes. "Outside, a pale silver hue hovered over the sky. It hadn't stopped snowing all evening. She stood by the balustrade, moved her foot, and dreamily brushed aside some of the snow with a maroon suede pump, then gently swept it off the ledge. I watched the snow scatter in the wind. I liked the gesture. Shoe, suede, snow, ledge, the whole thing done distractedly, with a cigarette between her fingers. I had never realized that there was a kind of beauty in stepping on fresh snow and leaving tracks. I always try to avoid the snow. I am good to my shoes. From my high perch, the silver-purple city looked aerial and distant and super-terrestrial, a beguiling kingdom whose beaming spires rose silently through the twilight winter mist to parley with the stars. I watched the fresh furrowed tracks on Riverside Drive, the scattered lampposts with their heads ablaze, and a bus crawling through the snow, tilting way past the knoll of 112th Street. A waiter opened the sliding door to the terrace and asked if we wanted anything to drink. Spotting a Bloody Mary on his tray, Clara, without hesitating, said she'd take that one. Before he had time to protest, she had already lifted it from his tray. I am Clara. I take things. The drink matched the color of her shirt. Then she stood the wide-rimmed glass on the balustrade, digging its base and part of its slim neck into the snow, either to keep it cold or to prevent it from tipping over with the first wind. When she was done smoking, she stubbed out her cigarette with her shoe, and then, just as she'd done with the snow, gently swept it off the ledge. I knew I'd never forget this moment. The shoes, the glass, the terrace, the ice floes plying down the Hudson, the bus shuffling up the drive. I tried to look away from her. And perhaps she, too, was looking away. Both of us now staring out at the evening sky where a faint, unsteady, bluish search beam emanating from an unknown corner of the Upper West Side orbited the sky, picking its way through the blotchy night as if in search of something it couldn't quite tell and didn't really mean to find. Each time it looped above us like a slim and trellised Roman Corvus, missing its landing each time it tried to come down on a Carthaginian ghost ship. Tonight, the Magi are truly lost, I wanted to say. But I kept it to myself, wondering how long we were going to stand like this and stare out into the dark, tracing the silent course of the light beam overhead as if it were a riveting spectacle justifying our silence. Perhaps by dint of scouring the sky, the beam might finally alight on something for us to talk about, except that there was nothing for the beam to land on, in which case, perhaps, we'd turn and the beam itself into a subject of conversation. I wonder where it's being aimed at, I might say, or where is it coming from, or why does it dip each time it seems to touch the northernmost spire, or looks like we're suddenly in London and this is the Blitz, or Montevideo, or Bellagio. Or there was the other ineffable question I kept spinning to myself as though it were a mini search beam searching within me as well. Bellagio, I said. What about Bellagio, she asked. Bellagio is a tiny village at the tip of a landmass on Lake Cuomo. I know Bellagio. I've been to Bellagio. Zapped. On special evenings, Bellagio is almost a fingertip away, an illuminated paradise, just a couple of our oar strokes from the western shore of Lake Como. On other nights, it seems not a furlong, but leagues and a lifetime away, unattainable. This right now is a Bellagio moment. What is a Bellagio moment? Are we speaking in code, you and I thought. I was treading on eggshells. If part of me didn't know where I was going with this, another felt that I was intentionally seeking dangerous terrain. Really want to know? Maybe I don't want to know. Then you've already guessed, Clara. Life on the other bank. Life as it's meant to be, not as we end up living it. Bellagio, not New Jersey. You were right the first time. When? When you said I'd already guessed. I didn't need the explanation. Snubbed and zapped again. Silence fell upon us. Mean and nasty, she finally said. Mean and nasty, I asked, though I knew exactly what she meant. Suddenly and without knowing it, I didn't want us to get too close, too personal. Didn't want us to stare, to start talking about the tension between us. She reminded me of a man and a woman who meet on a train and begin talking of meeting strangers on a train. Mean and nasty, Clara. It's what you're thinking, isn't it?
That's very beautiful. Thank you. It's always a privilege to read André, and it's always a special privilege to hear André read his own work. I'll never forget one evening when there was a series that André organized for us as part of the public programs in which he read one of his own stories, one essays about romance and love. And it was at Valentine's Day a few years back. And I had never had this experience before or since. At the end of the reading, which was probably a good 45 minutes or so, there was total silence in the room. And the fear was that somebody would get up and ask a dumb question because there were microphones. But everybody, there were like 450 people there, everybody was really smart enough not to spoil the moment because the prose itself was so gorgeous, and it always is in André's books. So that was a gift to all of us who were there that night, just as you're reading tonight is a gift to us. One of the things that always strikes me about André's writing is that everything is in its proper place, at least as I see it. When I read his last book, I sent him an email saying that I thought it was like a Mozart sonata, where there wasn't a single false note. Every image, the images in this book are absolutely exquisite. There are some strings of similes that are so perfectly selected and visual in their content. So the question is, how does he do it? I mean, when do you do it? How does this happen? You're a full-time faculty member. You've got doctoral candidates. You've got a family, all kinds of professional and family responsibilities. How do you make time to write so consistently, beautifully, and interestingly?
Aside from the fact that I have amazing help. You helped me. You gave me a room for a year, which was really fantastic. I mean, the Cullman Center is wonderful. I have a fantastic president who's allowed me to basically do what I want to do and have the leisure to do it without too many committee meetings, so that's fantastic. And I have a family that allows me to do that. And I help with homework. I get C's sometimes. B minus is usually my grade. But no, we do all those things. But I think the real word, and I don't want to sound foppish, but it is really, it's a form of love. I mean, you have to love doing this. And you have to want to do it with utter seriousness of purpose, no shortcuts. Mm-hmm. Shortcuts are very easy. It is really easy to give you the address where the person lives, or to give you his last name and his first name, and to tell you that his sister has, you know, Asperger's, and his father is unemployed, and his mother is mentally debilitated. And I could do this. This is easy. But to really stay honest with each book and each project, you have to reinvent the craft. Mm-hmm. Call Me By Your Name was not an easy book to write. It was very fast, but it was not an easy book to write. But I wanted to be honest. What does a 17-year-old want? And how does he go about getting it? And how is he going to be happy and disappointed and happy and disappointed again? This is a 28-year-old man, and he's after a woman who he feels is he doesn't deserve. What does he do? What do you have to do to create that and to be honest with it and to really make it memorable so that somebody, you don't just read it and you toss it. You actually want to go back to it because part of you is in the book now.
Well, let's talk about the craftsmanship of writing a book like this, though. I remember once asking Philip Roth if he set himself a page limit. It was a very pedestrian kind of question, but I thought one worth asking at that moment. And he writes every day, 7 hours a day. And he said, yes, one page a day. And then he does revisions, he rewrites and rewrites. Do you set yourself an objective?
I don't have the luxury of setting myself a luxury. I don't have those 7 consecutive hours, even with a sandwich thrown in. I don't have that. So I have to steal time, to cobble time together. It takes me a while to get on a roll, and I don't want to mess up the roll because then you have to go back to point zero all over again. I don't set myself. I know I cannot obey, but I write far fewer pages than one. I mean, I don't. I can't write a page a day. It's not going to happen. But if I can put together a paragraph that has a beginning and some sense of an end at the paragraph where I've captured the moment, then I've done my job, and I feel happy about it.
So how many years went into the book? Into this book?
Not that much. I mean, this book took, I had 9 months here, and then I stopped, and there was another month, and then about, I would say, 8 months. So that's all it took. But they were, I mean, you work intensely.
Does writing on the computer facilitate things for you?
For me, it certainly does, because every sentence gets rewritten, I don't know, 60, 70 times. Until you really are happy with it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I mean, I can go on forever explaining what I do. I start a sentence, then I write the next sentence, I say, my God, these are the same sentence. Why don't I just conjoin them? You know, you've repeated yourself. No, but I like this part. I don't want to take this out. What do I do? What if we move the sentence around? How about the participial phrase? No, too many participial phrases. I mean, this goes on all the time. The way I describe it is that as you write your sentence, and I'm doing this, but I'm really going like this. As you write your sentence and you're auto-correcting, sometimes you are already changing your mind about the sentence as you're halfway. So you now have to decide, do I go to the end or do I restart? Or you get to the end and you say, my God, you know, this is the end of the sentence, but what if instead of the period I put a comma? And then you say, because I'm not satisfied, this is like a great meal, no dessert. That's not going to work. What if I put a comma? Yeah, but what do I put after the comma? Well, you just think of something, and suddenly that little thing that was never going to happen because I hadn't put a comma, once I put the comma, and I just continue, just keep going, suddenly the miracle happens, and you've got yourself what I call a pearl. You've got your pearl in that sentence, in that paragraph. You've got it, and you're happy. And
there are a lot of pearls in this book. You must all read it. How did Proust do it?
Well, I mean, Proust was a much faster writer than I am. Proust was really a very fast writer, and if you look at the manuscript, you see that he changed his mind constantly, but he wrote very, very fast, and he edited very fast, and he was extremely prolific. The point of all, I think, of all good writers is that you are always at the beginning of a sentence, you're already looking 3 miles ahead, the way airplane pilots do. You are way ahead. You're thinking, where is this going to go? And you can go sort of block by block, the way I walk, or you can really sort of telegraph where the sentence is going to go. You don't want to give it away because the reader has to experience the joy of the discovery, but you have to plan ahead, and you're always planning ahead. And I think Proust did that too. And I, in a sense, I learned that's the part of the craft that I picked up from him, the fact that, like Coleridge, he's always envisioning the arch of the sentence way ahead.
These are some of those most gorgeous sentences I've read in a very long time, since I read Andre's last book, I think. tell us a little, let's go to something a little bit less sophisticated. Let's talk about your Facebook presence. Your publisher encouraged you to get a Facebook identity,
yes.
However one says it.
Oh, gosh, why did I do that?
You probably regret you ever told me that.
But. No. Everything I tell you obviously comes out here. I have to watch myself.
No,
actually, the New York Times said, because I have this program for writers, they said you absolutely need a Facebook. And I tell people who are going into their own business, especially in today's climate, people who lose their jobs and so on, I said, you have to have a Facebook proclaiming what you do and get all your friends and all their friends to know about you. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And lo and behold, I have a lot of fans. But I'm the kind of person, I'm not discriminatory. If you want to be my fan, I'll say yes. I ignore causes because that means I get a lot of mail about, you know, be good to this thing or do that thing. I couldn't care less. But if you want to be my friend, all of you, yes. It means nothing because I put nothing on my webpage, but on my Facebook. But once in a while, I'll put something if I get upset about something, or I'm happy about something, or if a student of mine has done something fantastic, I'll put it on Facebook. What has happened is that because of Call Me By Your Name, I think all of Italy, or the whole Italian gay community, has friended me. And the next thing I know is that the Indonesian gay community is also my friend. And I'm saying, yes, sure, yeah, come on, be my friend. And they're telling, and of course they tell all their friends and every. So it's an amazing universe. If I wanted to, I mean, I would be spending all my time writing to all these people because they all have interesting things to say. They've read, they read, they have interesting lives. And they want to share it with me, so they send me messages and things. And once in a while I'll answer because I feel I'm moved by people reaching out to me. It's a wonderful thing. But the most, just to go on this line, it's wonderful being an author because it's like throwing your business card to the air and everybody picks it up. And one of the letters that I got that was the most moving was a man who had bought Call Me By Your Name in England and was flying all the way to California in one flight. And he sent me a letter with no return address, with no name. And he said, I'm a married man. I bought your book. I read it on the airplane. I loved it. It was my life. I had to leave the book on the plane.
Wow.
Unsigned. And I still have it because it was so moving. And the letter was well written. Obviously, this man is smart. And he obviously had had some gay experience in the past. And he wanted not to talk about it. But it was very moving. And so I get a lot of these things. As an author, you can be totally swallowed up by this. And I try not to be because I have work to do. And it's very tempting to answer these emails and messages.
Do you answer some?
Yes, I do.
But not all?
No, I can't. There's no way I can.
How many might come in a day?
Well, four or five.
Uh-huh.
Not that many, but on a yearly basis, it adds up.
It does indeed.
And then some people also travel to come and hear me here. So I mean, I am lucky that way. It's really a wonderful feeling to have.
That's great. Well, if you don't answer them, maybe you'll answer your friends here tonight with some questions. How about that?
Sure. Pleasure.
Okay. Sir, yes.
In Call Me By Your Name, there's the part where he calls him by his name or tells him to call him by his name. And that idea is, like, very intense, or at least I thought it was intense. What inspired that? Where did this come from?
It's a very good question, by the way. You know, as a writer, things happen where you just go with the writing and suddenly you find yourself, and I'm not going to describe it, but you're describing what a human being can do with a fruit, for example. I mean, you find yourself doing those things. You go into those areas that you would never thought you would do. But the call Me By Your Name, it was just somehow it came to me that this was the utter form that intimacy could take when a person can call another person by his own name. In other words, you and I are one person now. And I know some people who have written to me and tell me they do that now. So that I said, you know, do I get 15% of that? I'd like to see who it is. I mean, you become very, I mean, I have a prurient side, there's no surprise. But I would like to know, how does it work? I mean, but essentially, you know, you sort of slip into certain domains that you have no anticipation for. And I mean, I think this is the real craft is that once you find yourself in a situation that you're unprepared for, what do you do? What do you do if you get to a sentence that's going out of control, is out of control, just syntactically? Do you give up? Do you close it? Do you do the safe thing? Or do you push it and you go beyond that? And I find that every time I have pushed the envelope a bit further has always been extremely rewarding. So there was nothing that prompted that, if you want to know. I could say, for example, I had two friends who became lovers, and they were both women, and they both had the same name. So, and I always thought to myself, how do they call themselves in moments of intimate congress, as Somerset Maugham would call it? And then what do they call each other? What do they say to each other? But I don't think it was that. This was just way in the backdrop, and you just go with it. That's the real answer that I can give you. It's an honest answer.
Another question?
In your new book, you went through great lengths to tell us how you've removed all these things that pertain to him, you know, his lineage, his... But why have you made him 28 years old? Why did you feel that age was necessary?
Because I think that anybody who reads this book... I mean, this is a self-select... I'm going to answer your question, but this book... basically, by virtue of the first paragraph, says to you, either you get this or put it back on the shelf or send it back to Amazon. Don't waste your time. Basically, it asks for a very sophisticated and very smart reader, which doesn't mean that the author is smart, okay? It's just the reader has to be. I thought that if I didn't specify the age, you would normally think that he might be like 40. But the reason why I said the reader has to be sophisticated is because every reader who's intelligent always feels that they're at least 15 years older than they seem. I was way older at the age of 17 than I am now. No, but I was very old for my age. I've always been very old for my age. And I think that everybody who's intelligent is very old. So I wanted to give you at least a sense, and it's not mentioned too many times, just once or twice. You know he's 28, and that's enough. So you know he's young enough to not be totally a beginner, but not too old to be sort of totally jaded. And so I needed to give that. So, in fact, that little prop was very necessary for me.
We do know something about his lineage, though, because we know about his mother and his father. We know that his father's dead. We know that his mother really did not love his father, but loved another man. And after the husband's death, she's now seeing that other man. I don't want to give away too much about what happens later on in the novel. So he's not totally sort of without any connections whatsoever. And I think when Andre mentioned that before, he wasn't talking about the specific character, but one can create a character with very few markers of identity. But this character is fleshed out very, very substantially, not only in terms of his own inner life, which is a major subject of the book, but also how he fits into a world on the Upper West Side, a set geography, a network of friends, old friends, new friends, past lovers, parents, and family ritual. Even though it's a Jewish family, there's a Christmas ritual that takes place all the time. That's not religious in nature, but it takes place at Christmas time. And so he does have a place in contemporary life in New York, in the world of cinema, and as a fan of Eric Rohmer's films and so on and so forth. And I think you had to do that.
I needed to do that because I'm interested. I want to tell you what street they're living on, what street Clara lives on, what building is it? Yesterday I took a fan of mine who comes from out of state and who happens to be sitting in this room. I took him to the house itself. I said, well, if it had to happen, this is the house. Okay, so I do that because I'm also interested in specifics. But I hate the Dickens thing. You know, X walks into the room. He had curly hair and mustache that came down this way. One eye was this way. He walked with this kind of gait. Enough already. I want to know what kind of human being it is. Clara, you know a few things. You know that she's sexy. You know that she's wearing a diaphanous crimson shirt. She has a diamond stud right here. And what else? And she is the shirt is unbuttoned to the breastbone. So you have a sense of a person, and now that when she says, I am Clara, you have a sense of the energy that she projects, and that's enough. Clara, however, also has this way about her that she renames everything around her, which is what insecure people do. They basically take this, and she's going to call the muffin a Prince Oscar. Then she's going to call him. She says, oh, don't be a Prince Oscar, which means don't be a fool. Don't be a silly man. And then she ends up calling him Prince, as in Prince Oscar.
With a Z.
With a Z, yes. And so essentially everything gets renamed. And he says, you know, if we stay together for a month, we'll be speaking a different language and nobody will understand us.
But he goes along with it, though.
He goes along. He enjoys it because it's a new life. She's kind of renaming every object around him. And when they have a picnic on his rug and she spills the wine by mistake on the rug, he says, oh, my God, this is the best thing that happened to this rug. It has a stain that will mark Clara's visit here forever. Don't ever clean it.
A rug that he bought with his father because his father thought it was important that he learn how to buy things at auction. So, you know, there are fuller dimensions to these things. But then the stain becomes something that is totemic. Is that a fair use of that
term? I suppose, yeah.
And you'll never take the salt off it that she had put on to absorb the wine. More questions.
I have a question that actually turns out to be about lineage and language. When I read Out of Egypt, I got the feeling that the family and the families that you described were not English speakers, and yet you, of course, were writing this book in English. So my question is, what was your path to English from where you grew up, and did you ever consider or have you written in other languages besides English?
My path to English, to answer the beginning of the question, is my father grew up in a French-speaking family, in a French-speaking community. And because he was such a contrarian, he decided that I had to go to a British school. And everybody kept telling him, why are you sending him to British school? What does he need to know English for when French, he could go to the lycée, and that would be perfectly. After all, you are moving to France, are you not? I said, yes, we are. But I want him to know English. So I went to an English school feeling totally sort of out of place. I had no knowledge of English. Everybody knew English. I didn't. But I picked up English, and I've always written in English. I wrote English poetry when I was a very young kid. And it stayed English all along. It feels sometimes a foreign language. It's not exactly my language. But then I would be lying to you if I said that French was. Because for me to write a letter in French, I have to go through all kinds of contortions. write in English, dear sir, it is my pleasure to be addressing you, most honorable, da 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 da, and then you go on and on and on and on, and I can't write this way. So I write these short Americanese sentences by which I try to convey, look, I can write a long sentence if I want to in French, but I prefer to be clear as an American is, okay? So, but actually French is, and I know Italian now. It was a great pleasure for me to be in Italy last summer and to be in this kind of a situation, being asked all these very complicated questions and being able to speak in Italian, but I can't write in Italian. I'd be making a fool of myself. So English has become my business language, and it is my personal language, mm-hmm. up to a point.
Other questions?
Professor Asimov? Yes. I just had a question about the role of ambivalence in your novel and the extent to which you say that is a paradigm for the way people interact in general and how the characters' feelings for one another are constantly in flux and changing in accordance with the other person's perception or their perception of that person's perception. Can you just comment on that in terms of the power or lack thereof of romance?
That's a question that makes me feel very ambivalent. I think I wrote an essay once, and it came out in the New York Times, where I said that every writer has an inner nerve, a sort of a hidden nerve, a hidden secret. And I said, after I gave a lot of examples of what it might be, I said that mine was ambivalence. In other words, ambivalence, which means that which is valued at two. It's ambi, like ambidextrous. So I have two values. Instead of having one thing, I have two of them. And I can't decide which it's going to be. And that is true of many of the things I do. So I don't, if the things I hate in the morning, I probably will like in the afternoon. And I mean this seriously. I think that when you meet someone new, and he says this in the novel, he meets someone, he says, please, please, he talks to himself, don't ruin it, don't look for defects so that you can dislike her, don't squelch the whole thing, leave it alone, enjoy it for what it is, even if it's threatening, okay? Don't turn ambivalent on it, because that's sort of a beginning of indecision. Maybe it's going to help you hate her eventually. You can hate anybody you want, but I think that ambivalence is it's sort of in this book, ambivalence is rock bottom. It is the last thing that you find. It's not something that you have to go beyond. There's nothing beyond ambivalence. And the irony is that Clara will, of course, reinvent the word and call it amphibolence, just for fun. And he likes the word amphibolence. And she says, you know, amphibolence strikes women too, if you care to know. That sort of thing. So like, I'm as undecided as you are, chum. Okay? So I don't know. I know you're writing about ambivalence right now. So the question is not totally inappropriate, but I hope this answered it up to point.
All right. Shall we conclude with a brief reading? Would you like that? I think so. That would be appropriate.
On the second night, he told her the night before that there was, oh, by the way, there's this Eric Rohmer Festival playing on the Upper West Side. And that's all he says. And sure enough, he goes the next day, and she's waiting for him there. She's bought two tickets, one for him and one for her. And he says to himself, what if I had come with someone? And of course, she had assumed that he wasn't going to. In fact, she kind of understood that the reason why he told her this was that she would show up. So after they see the movie, they go to a bar on the Upper West Side, and she puts a song on. And they listen to the song. The raucous words of the song cast a spell as soon as I heard them. They arose out of the late night stillness in the almost emptied bar like a wool blanket being unfolded from a linen closet on a cold night when the only sound you hear is hail and rattling window panes. Clara knew the words, and before I saw what was happening or had a chance to resist or even make a show of resistance, there I was, being asked to lead in a dance I vaguely remembered from my early college days. We danced by the jukebox, not 3 yards away from the entrance to the bar, and we danced much slower than a tango is meant to be danced, but who cared? For there we were, the jukebox and us, and the rare faces of passerbys on the sidewalk who happened to look in from behind the frosted windows, as in a Hopper painting under a lighted green Heineken sign, while one or two of the remaining waiters went about the business of refilling ketchup bottles. We thought we danced perfectly. We thought this was heaven. We thought tango had brought us closer in 3 seconds than all the words we'd been sparring with since 7:10 p.m. And then it happened. After the song, she stood still for a second, and with her hand still in mine, almost in jest, or was it in jest, said, "Perdóname." And right then and there began singing out the words in Spanish. And she sang them for me a cappella, with that voice that tore everything inside of me, staring at me the way singers do when they unhinge you totally as you stand there helpless and bared, and all you have is a shaken self and tears running down your cheeks. And she watched this, and she didn't stop singing, as if she knew, as she began to wipe my eyes with her palm, that this couldn't have been more natural and was exactly what should happen when one human being stops dancing, holds your hand, and then sings to you, for you. Sings because music, like a machete in the jungle, cuts through everything and goes straight to that place we still like to call the heart. "Please don't, don't," she whispered. Then, changing her mind, went back to Perdóname, her song.
Wow, beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, both André Assimon and Paul Leclerc. Thank you.